You're tuned to Perspectives, a weekly public affairs show which airs every Saturday right here on KTEP. Good afternoon. I'm Louis Sines, your host for Perspectives, and joining us today are Dr. Meredith Abarca and also doctoral student Consuelo Salas. Dr. Abarca is with the English department, and it's been a while since Dr. Abarca has been with us. However, occasionally she appears in some of the Christmas programming that we have because we talk about food and folklore, and of course, Dr. West lend a lot of that to us. Rest in peace. What a great man he was. But anyway, thank you very much for being with us here today.
Thank you for having us.
First of all, Meredith, we were discussing before the program started because I said, I'm surprised that the English department is sponsoring this. And we talked about stereotypes and how people tend to look at different things in a different way. Like when we talk about English, we think about literature, we think about grammar, we think about books and all that stuff. And you're area of expertise is food, the study of food, humanities, all that stuff.
Well, first of all, thank you for having us.
You're welcome.
I appreciate that. I appreciate this opportunity. But first of all, I do study literature, but the focus that I give to the literature that I study is primarily how food is, it's in the literature. Once you start paying attention, you realize that every story you read, every poem you read, every essay you read, there's going to be food imagery or food symbolism or there's scenes that happen in the kitchen. So my initial approach to food studies in terms of literature is what happens when food comes in a story. Let me tell you a little bit about me, if I might, for just like 2 minutes, so I can explain how I came into food. Actually, when I was very, very young, I grew up in restaurants. When I was in high school, my dream was to be a chef. I took a training for a while in a gourmet chef in Redwood City, California. And then I saw how hard that life was. And then, you know, move on, and I discovered literature, and I fell in love with it. And somehow, when I was in graduate school, I came back to food as an area of research. My initiation into looking at food studies was when I was writing my dissertation, and I thought about what kind of creativity outlets the working class women have. And that's really how I started looking at the kitchen as a studio, looking at food as to what stories are communicating with somebody gives you a recipe. Because I've discovered that it goes beyond the recipe. There's always a family history, a cultural implication, and so on and so forth. As of now, I've been doing food studies officially, I guess you can say, for the last 15 years. As you said earlier at the beginning of the program, I am in the English department. But at this point in my career, I'm comfortable saying that I'm really a food scholar. The people who cite my word and know my work are really all the people that call themselves food scholars. Food studies has become, in the last probably 20 years or so, really a major area of scholarship. It is a very interdisciplinary area of scholarship.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that because, you know, various areas of the country, various, you know, in the South, they eat a certain way. In the East, they eat a certain way. We eat a certain way. Mexican food here is very different compared to Mexican food in New Mexico. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that was brought up recently when I did an interview with a journalist who studies cancer, the fact that this one man who survived both bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki ended up dying of stomach cancer. And it turns out that they had a high incidence of stomach cancer in this area of Japan because they ate salted fish. And so, as you and I were discussing before the program started, there are a lot of documentaries coming out now showing us exactly what is behind that food. What is it that you're eating? Are you really eating a hamburger? Are you really eating a steak? What are you eating, and how does that affect our mood? How does that affect, like you said, there's a story behind everything. And I find it interesting that in our cultures, you know, we used to watch our mothers cook and they would tell stories about, you know, this is your grandmother's recipe, et cetera, et cetera. And nobody ever imagined that us sitting there watching our mothers cook would someday become a TV show. And not that our mothers would become famous, but other cooks. And we sit there on the couch watching somebody else cook.
Right. From a perspective of a food scholar, I find that very, very fascinating that, I mean, food is in many ways. My question, though, is food in because we are cooking more, or is food in the shows that you mentioned because we're becoming this sort of kind of visual eaters, so to speak? We just see it, but we don't necessarily are cooking it. So to me, those are, as a food scholar, those are fascinating questions. Why is it that there's so many shows on television now about food. What is it? Is that feeding a gap that we might have in our own lives, our own relationships with other people? Because most of us are not longer really cooking at home or sitting at the table having dinner with the families. Are we substituting that through this visual representation on the television?
Consuelo?
Right. This is actually one of my research interests. So these phenomenon of having cooking shows online where you can now stream videos live or you can watch a recipe being made live via your iPad or your phone via the cooking shows websites. It's interesting to me because I feel within that dynamic of having it in the kitchen space but having it through the electronic means, what's that story or what's not being told through that story, through that recipe that you would get if you had your mother or your some member of your family sitting there telling you the story behind this spoon as opposed to just having it from a third party into now entering into your kitchen. And what's interesting is that cookbooks are now becoming bestsellers, but people aren't necessarily cooking with them. They're reading them as they would just another literary text. So it's an interesting phenomenon to see that there is this push that food is becoming such a high concentration of interest, but understanding what that interest is and why there is that interest is something that I'm interested in.
When you talk about people being interested in, from your research, have you found out, are they interested in the actual dish itself, or are they interested in more in watching this person and what they're doing? Because as you and I know, growing up watching our grandmothers or our mothers cook, they wouldn't say a tablespoon of this. They would say una puñalada de esto, a pinch of this, a pinch of that. And it was, you know, just like they would say, well, I just kind of know what to do.
Right. It's interesting because most of these shows have the exact recipes on there. And another part that I'm interested in is what agency or how do the readers respond or viewers of these websites respond to those recipes? So do they feel that they have the power to critique them or to provide substitutions or say, I did this instead of adding maybe a tablespoon of that? So what is that viewer interaction or those watchers' interactions with those set recipes that are now online? Do they take agency to manipulate them or play with them? And then do they offer their stories as to why? So there's a little bit of both. There's some readers who just say that they take the recipe at face value, and then there's others who will take ownership of that recipe and adapt it for themselves and provide that history of why they feel they should have that adaptation.
And not only that, it brings me to I remember when Paula Deen made that comment on television. All of a sudden, here's a lady who's cooking, and she's become a celebrity, but now she's become an even bigger celebrity because of something she said on the show, whether you were on her side or were against it. So there's a lot of power in the media there.
There definitely is. And even when Paula Deen came out stating that she had been diagnosed with diabetes, there was a huge backlash of her recipes. And so now her son is actually taking his mother's recipes and making them more healthy. So he's trying to adapt them so that there's not as much butter, not as much salt, things that Paula Deen was known for that quote-unquote southern cooking. When she came out that she had diabetes, there was a lot of backlash. How could you present these recipes to people knowing that you had this but still not making any adaptations on the way that you were preparing these dishes yourself? So now her son is championing that and is making an effort to make his mother's recipes, but a healthier version of them.
It's interesting how, I mean, who would have ever thought that social media would play a major role in cooking and in food and in eating? And you know that people go to Facebook to find out what's the best place to eat, or they tell us where they're eating or what they eat. And so with that in mind, let's get back to the conference that's going to be coming up this coming Wednesday and Thursday. Is that correct,
Meredith? Yeah, Wednesday, February 5th from 6:30 to 8 p.m. and then Thursday, February 6th, also from 6:30 to 8 p.m. at the Reuben Center. Before I say a thing about the conference, let me go back to,
sure,
to this idea of power and media and social media that to me is important as a food scholar to people's awareness. It's precisely the kind of power that is behind food. Recently, I went to a high school, Cathedral High School, and talked about food studies. Essentially, what is food studies? How do I define food studies? And the way that I define it is, it's the way to examine a society's structure through the lens of food. And by structure, I mean its culture, its history, its politics, its economics, its philosophy, its values, but through the lens of food. And as I was telling this to the students, I said that in food studies, we always think of what I call, I'm not suggesting that every scholar would use these words, but I do, the three pillars of food studies, which is production, distribution, and consumption. And within those three things, there's tremendous amount of power. And with power or control, and with control comes power. So food is a very powerful entity, industry, force in our lives. That brings me back to the conference. Early on, we started the show by saying that I'm in the English department, and that's in a little strange to be a food scholar. Usually when I tell people that I'm a food scholar or that I do food studies, people usually make the assumption that, oh, you're in nutrition, you're in the health sciences, or you're in anthropology, if I'm not in the health sciences. The reason why I'm bringing this conference, this is actually the third food studies symposium that we have in here at UTEP. So this is the third one that I'm organizing. It's precisely to share with other people what scholars from the humanities, from different areas in the humanities, are doing with food, because it's studied through history, through anthropology, through philosophy. So motivated by that, Consuelo and I, because this is a project that the two of us are doing together, putting this conference together, this symposium together, it's a two-part lecture, and we're calling it the study of food in the humanities, to talk to people, to share with people what we in the humanities, faculty in the humanities, are doing with food. We are bringing four phenomenal scholars from different parts of the United States. Dr. Gary Napham, who's been here in El Paso before, he's from Arizona. He deals a lot with native foods, sort of kind of preserving native seeds and eating locally. We are also bringing Dr. Lisa Helke. She's a philosopher. Dr. Carol Cunahan, she's an anthropologist. And Dr. Psyche Williams-Forson, she does American studies. And they all kind of give us 30-minute lectures, different topics in the lectures. But the gist of the lecture is going to be the role that food or the study of food has for the humanities as a whole.
Can you give us some examples of some of the things perhaps that they're going to talk about, Consuelo?
Sure. Earlier we were talking about that history that food has. So if we, and I'm borrowing from Meredith, that she's developing a concept known as food consciousness. So understanding the history behind our food. So understanding that food is not only nutrition, but that there is that cultural aspect to food. So there's the history, the trajectory of that history. So how is it that we have derived at having enchiladas on our plate? So what's the history behind that dish? And also, what are maybe the cultural implications of having that dish or having tamales at Christmas, using lard within the masa for the tamales? That history of how the foods that we currently eat have come to be, not only culturally, but even within our individual families. And also, Lisa Helke is somebody that I really admire and who I feel, for my field in rhetoric, has asked a very important question. She has asked, what would have happened if Plato had taken food seriously, if he hadn't dismissed it as something that was just corporal and had done the mind-body dichotomy? What would have happened to Western philosophy if we had taken food a little bit more seriously? What would our relationship with food be, maybe even our relationship with the environment be, if those early scholars had taken food a little bit more seriously? So understanding that relationship with food, because there is the nutritional value, and sometimes that's what people think of first, but then also understanding that cultural aspect, which is where the humanities can come in, and understand why is it difficult for people to separate themselves from certain eating habits. Is it largely because of their cultural implications for them? These are foods that they grew up with, that they have these stories with, that they have these connections with. So understanding both the nutrition and the cultural aspects of food can help to understand food, our relationship with food, a little bit better.
There's a Dr. Cousins, and he wrote a book called Simply Raw, where he basically was trying to get diabetics to eat healthier by just eating raw foods. And he chose a diversity of people. As far as I know, he didn't choose any Hispanics, but he chose two African-Americans. He chose a young Anglo man and a Native American. And the African-Americans and the Native American were having very difficult times because they were used to having the fried foods and some of that stuff. And the Native American ended up leaving the camp because he couldn't take it. And as you mentioned, history shows us what people have eaten over the years. And it's even gotten into, as you talk about the humanities, it's gotten into religious studies because, as you know, Catholics here during Lent, they eat a special food. You hear about the Jewish people eating kosher food. And then most recently, I'm reading a book called, I think it's called The Green Zone, and it's about the soldiers who are in Afghanistan, and they eat a lot of pork. They eat a lot of, you know, fat foods and stuff like that. And it's almost, you know, well, it is a sin for the Islamic people who live there and work there, seeing these people consume this huge amount of pork. And so it's in that part as well.
If I may interject here for
sure.
a second, when you're talking about land, for instance, there's a wonderful book called Fish on Friday that explains the history as to why, you know, within Catholicism, why we do, we eat fish on Friday. And it talks about sort of like the power and economic aspects of who controlled the fish, who had the salt, and who needed to sell it. So it's a slightly different spin. I mean, you can, you know, you can read it and judge for yourself whether you believe in this or not. But one of the issues in terms of some of my work, for instance, or my questioning is, do we come with a culture justification in terms of eating practices, but the background is really has been more a political economic logic or argument that is as easy for us to accept it as a cultural symbolic aspect of our culture rather than say, well, at some historical point, this was imposed on us because we had no other choice. Those are part, as a food scholar for me, the kind of food scholarship that I like to do, I sort of like to look at the sort of big historical movements also. When did something become a practice and why? Why do we eat fish on Fridays? You know, why couldn't it be cacti?
Sure.
Or couldn't it be something else? Why the people in the area of Tuscany do not use salt in the bread? Because they didn't have access to salt for a long time. You were talking a minute ago about Southern foods
and fried,
and issues of food in location. One of their speakers, Dr. Asaki William Forson, if I'm just read the title of her lecture, because I think it shows the multiple dynamics of food. Her lecture is called Crossing Borders by Policing the Plate, Bringing Gender, Race, Class, and Region into Food Studies. So in her case, it has all these other dimensions too. The food says something about gender. It says something about class. It says something about a race. And in her presentation, she's going to talk about how these forces, these entities come together and how do they inform certain things that people eat or don't eat or are able to eat or are not able to eat, depending on who they are and where they are.
And it's interesting, too. I guess it's how it's presented because, and I'm paraphrasing here because I don't remember the exact quote, but Al Capone said during Prohibition, you know, if somebody offers you a drink in a warehouse, it's breaking the law. But if someone offers you a drink at a party, it's hospitality.
Mm-hmm.
And so it depends on how that food, you know, a food that may look like, oh my gosh, I would never eat that. But if it's presented in a different way, all of a sudden, I mean, snails are snails and then escargot is something different.
Well, actually, this brings another issue in terms of food studies in the humanities and rhetoric and movement and changes that happen. You know, a lot of foods or dishes that begin as working class dishes because that's what a certain community, at a certain economic, socioeconomic class can only afford to eat, somehow it becomes appropriated by the food industry and then becomes this trendy food and becomes very expensive. I always give the example of fajitas. I mean, it's made with the least expensive cut of meat.
The flank steak, yeah.
Yes. But this is what people used to eat because they had no other means of another cut of meat. But now if you go to a restaurant, how much are you going to pay for a fajita?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And there's a number of dishes that have gone through this transition. What I call working class food that somehow becomes discovered, quote unquote, and remarketed.
Mm-hmm.
And in my case, I call it appropriation of somebody's culture. And then you sell it. You sell what you created out of that imitation for a lot more money. But also part of the issue that for me is very important is that we, when the industry sort of appropriates certain dishes from particular cultures, we forget who the people behind, who the actual people who started cooking this. So part of what I do with my job, with my research, with my writing, with my presentations, with what I'm trying to accomplish with bringing this conference together, what Consuelo and I are trying to accomplish, is sort of bring the idea of agency, that there's people. It's not just corn. It's who learned to cook it, you know, who learned to do this. It's not just pozole or the tamales, but who learned to do them and why did they do them? Why is this important for people? Sometimes when we talk about food, we can get too caught up on the item itself, on the dish or on the ingredient. But for me, it's important to keep remembering there's a person, there's knowledge behind that ingredient as to who knew how to use it.
And it's interesting how what you mentioned about the fajitas, because you can pay $1.50 for a burrito, but you're going to pay $7.50 for a wrap.
Exactly.
Oh, exactly.
Exactly. So going back to this lecture, if I may, like I said, we're bringing these four scholars. They'll be here Wednesday and Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
There are four components to this food study symposium. The first one, one of them, as we already said, is the two lectures. They're going to be held at the Rubin Center. Just again to repeat, February 5th, Wednesday, and February 6th, Thursday from 6:30 to 8 p.m. One night, Dr. Napham and Dr. Helkin would speak. And then on Thursday, Dr. Cunahan and Dr. William Forson would give the lectures. But in addition to this, we have two round tables that we would like to invite our students and our faculty and UTEP. And Gonzalo will tell us a little bit about the round tables.
Yes, so we're going to be having two round tables on Thursday, February 6th. The first one is going to be student-centered. So any students out there who are interested in food, who find this topic fascinating and who would just like to come and hear what these scholars have to say, we'll be having a roundtable discussion from 9 a.m. to 10:20 a.m. on Thursday, February 6th in Liberal Arts, room 304. And so currently the members of the roundtable will include the four visiting scholars, so Dr. Carol Cunahan, Dr. Napham, Dr. Williams Forson, and Dr. Helke. But we also have a few students from the UTEP community, including myself and Joshua Colby from American Literature, David Jacobson from the Department of History, Jose Leyva from Anthropology and History, Lorraine Perez from Communication Studies, Ian Roa from Anthropology and History, and Maria Ruiz Pineda from Anthropology. So what I hope to advertise here is that if you have an interest in food, if you're a student at UTEP who has an interest in food, and you would like to maybe understand how other scholars are using food within their disciplines, this would be a good discussion to come and sit in and also maybe contribute towards the end. We are going to provide a space to share how our research interests were founded in food, how we came to that field, what we are currently doing, and also what interests we just have, even at the preliminary stages, because some of these students are at different stages of their interest. So there'll be myself, I've had an interest for about 4 years, thanks to Dr. Abarca. Joshua Colby has been doing this for about 2-3 years. And some of the students just have an interest and want to come and join the discussion. So whatever your level of interest in, this will be a good discussion just to kind of explore what are the different venues, the different ways that you can explore food within your particular discipline.
Now, the conference itself, is that going to be open to the public, general public?
Yes, it's open to the public. It's free. It's at the Rubin Center, and we have reserved some parking spaces, so there should be some availability for people to park from the community.
And what number should they call if they have additional information, questions that perhaps we didn't answer?
Probably the best number is to call 747-0619. And that's my number. They can reach me there. 747-0619.
I know we tend to forget because we don't call ourselves
right.
A lot of times. Okay.
If we can take a few more minutes.
Sure, we can.
Just for Consuelo to tell us about the second round table.
Yes. And same day, February 6th, Thursday, February 6th, we will also be having a round table discussion. And this one is more faculty centered. So what we have is we have the four visiting scholars again, but we also have members of the faculty. So we have Lucia Dura from Rhetoric and Writing Studies, and we also are including a few members of the faculty from the Health Department, the Public Health Sciences Department. We also have a few members of the community. So Catherine Yanez from La Semilla will be joining us, Adam Lampenstein, who is the co-owner of the Ripe Restaurant, and also Joy Leos, who is the health project coordinator for Eat Well El Paso. And so this roundtable is actually geared towards more how can the faculty at UTEP see what members of the community are already doing with issues of food, and how can we start to build bridges between the university and what's already being enacted in the community. And some of the scholars from the Department of Public Health Sciences are actually already doing these, so just to bridge even across disciplines what's already happening, for the health sciences to know what's happening in the humanities and for the humanities to know what's happening in the health sciences. So from the health sciences, we'll have Dr. Maria Duarte, who is the chair of the Department of Public Health Sciences, Dr. Thenral Mangadu, who is with the Public Health Sciences, and Dr. Leo Wigum, who is the executive director of the Paso del Norte Institute for Healthy Living, so that we can just start to bridge these conversations not only amongst disciplines, but also from the university to the community. So any interested faculty who would like to see what is happening with these issues, more than welcome to attend. And this will be, again, February 6th, 3 to 4:20 in Hudspeth Hall 100.
I just wanted to make sure that we set the time.
Okay. Now, you mentioned several books earlier that you've read. People might wonder at home if the scholars or yourself will have books or other information available that perhaps you can purchase or take home.
At the lectures, we'll have a table and we'll be selling, UTEP will be selling. I ordered two books. I mean, they're just hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of books on food. And every year, every week, more comes out. But the ones that we order are two books that edited by Carol, Dr. Cunahan and Dr. William Forsen, that is called Taking Food Public. The other one is what I like to call the Bible of food and cultural studies, that I think all of us who do food studies in relationship to culture have this book in our office and teach this book. It's called Food and Culture,
A Reader,
published by Routledge. And we selected that book to be sold at the lectures. Like I said, it's really a wonderful foundation about food studies. And B, all food scholars who are coming have an article in it. So that way people can, you know, if you want to buy the book, they actually would take something with them, an article. These scholars are extremely prolific writers. Gary Napham has tons and tons of books out. I invite anybody who's curious to just Google them, and you will find the scholarship.
Okay, well, we'd like to thank you both very much for taking the time to be with us here today. We've been visiting with Dr. Meredith Abarca. She is a professor in the English department, and her area of expertise is food studies, and also doctoral student Consuelo Salas. Well, we'd like to thank you both very much for being with us here today. And again, once again, the name of the conference is the Study of Food and the Humanities, and it will start Wednesday and Thursday. It will be at the Rubin Center for Visual Arts from 6:30 to 8 p.m. But again, as Consuelo and Meredith mentioned, there are also going to be some roundtable discussions for students and for faculty. And if you're interested in finding out more information about that, you can call 747-0619. That's 747-0619. Ladies, thank you very much for being with us here today.
Thank you for having us. It's First, a pleasure.
Thank you. Perspectives is taped and produced at the KTP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer and producer, Dennis Wu. You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Louis Sines.